The Steve Lobby Agency presents The Christian Publishing Show, a podcast for writers who want to advance Christ's kingdom using the written word. Here's your host, Thomas Umstadt Jr.
The biggest competition for authors is not other books or other authors. It's movies. Movies often have scores of writers working together, and most people hungry for story prefer to watch a movie in the evening than to read a book. And even many authors secretly have subscriptions to Netflix. So the most popular books borrow writing techniques from Hollywood. And if you want your book to be popular in the 2020s, you need to do the same. The Victorian era is over. Long live the Victorian era. So our guest today is probably best known for her novel, A Vow to Cherish, the inspiration for the award-winning film of the same title. She's written over 35 books for imprints of Random House, Simon & Schuster, and HarperCollins, among many others. So Deborah Rainey, welcome to the Christian Publishing Show.
Thank you, Thomas. It's great to be here.
So what does it mean to write cinematically?
Well, most writers in their earliest courses hear show, don't tell. That is probably the number one writing rule. And in a sense, writing cinematically simply means to put your story on stage. You know, when my first novel became a movie, and Ken and I got to go to Hollywood and see the movie premiere, and the first thing that shocked me was how much they changed from my book. That always happens, and one of the big reasons is that, you know, a book, if you get an audio book, is going to be 8 or 9 hours long. A movie can't be that long. So they have to shorten your story to make it into a movie. But the thing that I realized was that so much of my first novel took place in my characters' heads. I had them driving somewhere, thinking, you know, sitting in the kitchen, remembering. And that does not translate well to film. And I'm so glad it happened with my first novel, because I learned so much that I apply to every novel afterwards, that, you know, makes a huge difference.
That's really good. And another advantage of writing cinematically, not only is it easier for a reader to kind of appreciate the story because it's more like the kinds of stories that they're watching on screen, but when your book is made into a movie, more of it is preserved.
Yes.
A good example of this is the Hunger Games books, which were written in a very cinematic way, very visceral, very visual, despite being written in first person, which is interesting. You'd think that the whole story would take place in Katniss's head, and yet it doesn't. In fact, she's slowly going crazy over the series of the books because she's got so much trauma. And yet when you watch the movies, it's virtually the same story. The point of view is a little bit different, but very little has changed because the story was very easily adapted to the film. They didn't have to make major changes to it.
Yes. And that makes it so much easier for the screenwriter, because it's usually not the author of the novel who does the screenplay. So yeah, good point.
So why is cinematic writing important for Christian authors? Why do we even need to learn this? Can't we just write the way we want to?
Well, first of all, if you want your book to be turned into a movie at some point, and most authors that I talk to, that's the ultimate dream, if someday your movie or your novel got picked up and turned into a movie. But, you know, the other reason is that we want readers to stick with us. We want them to read our books and love our books. And the way that that happens is when you make your story come alive in your reader's head, when they literally can picture it as they're reading, picture it like a movie. And I always say, I wish as an author that there was some way that I could go back in somebody else's head and read my own book and just see how it translates. Because, you know, as an author, you have so much in your head that you think you're getting on the page and isn't necessarily making it to the page.
That's right. One of the fun things about writing fantasy and science fiction, especially for a younger audience, is that it's very common for younger readers to draw the characters in the scenes from the stories that they're writing. In fact, this is one of the things I teach in my blogging classes. You know, ask your readers for their fan art, because it may already exist. They just need to take a photo of it with their smartphones and send it to you, and you can share it on your blog. They're happy, you're happy, your other readers are happy. But it's often really surprising what, when they're drawing your characters or your monsters, your aliens or whatever, what they look like. Like, that's not what it looked like in my head. And yet when you described it, that's how it got revealed in their head.
Yeah. And that brings up a good point. I try not to describe my characters too vividly because I want my reader to bring to the book what they want to. I'll usually, especially if there's an element of romance, I will usually tell what color of their eyes are, that kind of thing, just because that is what the hero will be noticing about the heroine and vice versa. But other than that, I try not to give too much description of the characters. The setting for me is really more important to describe. The way if it were a play, or, you know, I try to set the stage the way if it would be if it were a play. And that way the reader can bring the character that they want to read about to the story, but I've already set the stage that they can walk around on.
That's so good. So how do you write cinematically while avoiding mediocrity?
Avoiding mediocrity. Ooh, that's a tough one. I literally, when I figured out that it was all about making the reader see this thing as if it were a movie, and especially then getting to see what the screenplay for About a Cherish looked like, and, you know, just how the lines were supposed to be read and that type of thing, I started looking at screenwriting. And even just if you would Google a glossary for film terms, film phrases and that kind of thing, and start looking at those individually and thinking, how can I apply this particular film term to my movie? So, for instance, a cliffhanger. And actually, that's a funny one because cliffhangers actually probably started with books before they did start with movies. But then we've all got the cowboy movie in mind, you know, where the guy is literally hanging from a cliff. And that's where the term came from. But there are ways that you can translate that idea of having your character on a ledge and you don't know what's going to happen next, and make your reader turn the page because they, even if it's 2 o'clock in the morning and they've already said just one more chapter 3 times, find a way to make them turn the page and find out what happens next.
Or do what's really cruel but really keeps people reading. You leave one character hanging on a cliff, and then you switch to a different character. There is a moment, I think it was in Lord of the Rings, if I'm remembering this correctly, where Sam is there. He's got the ring. He's got the mithril coat, and he's got the sword. Frodo has been captured, and the doors are closed in front of him. The chapter ends, and the first word of the next chapter is Pippin. And you're like, no! What happened to Frodo? And you have to read a whole book about Pippin. And then finally, you're like really caring about Pippin, and it kind of switches back to Frodo. And, you know, you may think, oh, that's cruel. Why would a writer do that? But what you're doing there is you're managing tension. Yes. And you have to always have some unanswered question that they have to keep reading in order to answer. And you want to answer each question with additional questions, because you never want them to be like, oh, okay, I'm done, you know, halfway through the book. Because if they do that, they're not going to read the next book.
Exactly. But I will say there is a fine line between making your reader mad because you just have gone on too long. They better really love that next character that you move to, you know, before you finally, at least partially, answer that question that you left them hanging with.
I couldn't agree more. In fact, Robert Jordan is another author that I read, and he had his epic Wheel of Time series. And one of his characters, I couldn't stand, and I almost started editing his book to just skip past that character's point of view, because I'm like, I really don't care what he's going on about. But what was interesting is that my best friend, that was his favorite character, and my favorite character was my friend's least favorite character. And so it was interesting how different characters will resonate with different audiences. And this is actually a technique that's used in cinema where, because they measure really carefully who's coming to the theater, right? Are men coming to the theater, or women, what ages, what ethnicities, and they try to put characters into films that will appeal to certain demographics. And so one of the things you'll notice in cinema is that there's a lot more Asian characters now than there was 10 years ago. You're like, why is that? Well, they're trying to appeal to Asian moviegoers. The number two place for the box office right now, or at least it was before the coronavirus, was China, right? Like China spends more on movies than any other country other than the United States. And so appealing to them and having characters that appeal to that audience is really important. And so one of the ways that a cinematographer, a movie filmmaker creates characters is not just what would this character be interesting, but also who would this character bring to the movie, right? There's a big mistake that's been made in recent films where there's no male characters in the story, or the only male characters are all evil. And then the filmmakers are shocked that no men want to watch the movie and it's got this really high female score.
That is a fascinating point, because my husband loves to watch World War II movies, or really just about any war movies. And my gauge of whether this is a movie I will be able to sit and watch with him, is there any woman? Is there even one woman in the movie? And if there's not, that means that we're not going to be delving into the families and, you know, that were left back home and that type of thing. It's all going to be about the shoot 'em up war part of the thing. And I'm not interested in that. So excellent point. Yeah. And it's funny because I write women's fiction. That is my genre. But I have a surprising number of male readers. I get reviews from men. I get letters and comments from men. And now I will say that usually when I hear from a man, it's because his wife put my book in his hand.
So you're still selling to the woman.
Yes, exactly. So I am selling to the woman, but I really value my male readers, and I try to write for them. I try to have something in my book that will be of interest to them.
This is actually another cinematographic point, because it's same thing, right? You have a date movie. You want enough elements where the husband will go with his wife, or the boyfriend will go with his girlfriend, right? They're going on dates and she's trying to drag him to the film. There has to be something to appeal to him. It's the same reason why McDonald's offers salad, right? No one goes to McDonald's for salad, but if you've got a group of people who are wanting to go to McDonald's and one person eats healthy, they can veto the whole group going to McDonald's unless there's something for them. And so this is kind of here's a thing on the side for the one salad eater. Everyone else can eat their junk food. It's the same approach with the film. It's like, give them just enough where they won't veto the movie, right? So for you, if there's not a single woman in the war movie, you're like, you go on your own. And suddenly that's a ticket that they're not selling to you. Whereas if, you know, there's a plot line with the wife back home, you know, getting telegrams and, you know, that whole is like, okay, that's enough for me to be willing to sit next to my husband while the bombs are going off.
Yes. And that kind of explains why when Ken goes to a chick flick with me, the high compliment is, yeah, that was actually pretty good. Yeah, so, and that means there was something in it for him too. So
that's right. And his money spent just as well as your money did. Now, what are some roadblocks to watch out for when writing cinematically?
Well, for one thing, you still have to write spare. You do want to set the stage and you want to be very specific, but you don't want paragraph after paragraph of description, because those are the things the reader will skip right over. I probably spend 30 minutes working on the first paragraph of every chapter of every book. And or every scene change, I should say, because sometimes there'll be three chapters and we're all in the same on the same stage. But anytime the stage changes or I change points of view and I'm moving into another character's head, I am very, very careful in that very first paragraph to make sure that I create a vivid image in my reader's head. And the reason for that is so that everything else I write after that already has a foundation. I don't have to work nearly as hard on the entire rest of the chapter if I have laid that foundation so that my reader has an image. And I like to tell the story about a manuscript that I was critiquing at a conference, and it was mostly dialogue, which is wonderful. I mean, that's what movies are all about, is dialogue. And as a reader, anytime you turn the page and you see that there's a lot of white space and it's going to be a conversation, that means you're going to read through pages quickly. And we like that. That's where the story moves and where we get to know the characters. So I'm reading this dialogue and it was extremely well written. It was a mother and her daughter, and there was a lot of tension between them. They were having an argument. But what the writer failed to do was set that stage. So the reader, which was me, automatically has to have something, especially if you're a visual reader. You have to have something to put that dialogue on. And so what I did is I thought, okay, I'll just put them in a coffee shop real quick. Just in my mind, you know, that thought goes through. So I'm picturing them slamming down forks and setting the teacup down harder than it needed to. Imagine my shock when they were broadsided by a semi. See, my writer had not told me that they were in a car. And it would have been so easy to just set that image. You could do that with three words, you know, or I'm not going to count words, but she gripped the steering wheel. Four words, however many that was. But you get the picture. All you have to, we don't care what kind of car. We just need to know that they are in a car. And then you can use everything in the car to show us the emotions of your character. If her knuckles are white and she's gripping the steering wheel, we see her anger and we see, you know, and in fact, a writer can do even more than a filmmaker can do with those kinds of things, because you can't really see white knuckles in a movie. I guess if they zoom in, you can. But just there's so much you can do if you set the stage first.
There's so much here that's really good. I almost feel like you could drop the microphone and walk away if your microphone wasn't so expensive. Because that principle, and I really want to underline this because I think this is so good, of focusing not just on the first paragraph of your first chapter, which everyone knows to do that, but the first paragraph of each scene change. Because what is the point you're most likely going to lose a reader, right? When do they put your book down and go to sleep? You don't want them going to sleep. You want them to keep reading, or, you know, to have that tension high enough so that the next day they pick up where they left off. And where you lose readers is at the end of scenes. And so if you can leave your scene strong and then start the next scene strong, it's kind of like getting that top button of your shirt in the right spot and all the other buttons line up after it. And the other thing you said that's really good is that there are ways that we can write cinematically better than the cinema. And going back to Hunger Games, there's some things in Hunger Games that are incredibly visceral that are lost in the movie, specifically smell and taste, right? Katniss Everdeen is incredibly hungry for most of the book. Why? Because it's the Hunger Games. And so she's smelling, like if you've ever been fasting, you know, your smell heightens and you can smell things better because you're hungry. She never says that. She shows that, right? Katniss has got a super nose the hungrier she gets. And that is a level of visceralness of senses that a filmmaker really can't convey. Even when, like, there's a rotting corpse on the screen, right? Somebody, remember this one movie where the good guy's running away from the bad guys and he jumps off a waterfall, and in the river below the rotting waterfall was a dead animal of some kind, and he hides under the dead animal and the bad guys can't find him and the dogs can't find him because it smells so bad, right? Even then, I'm not feeling the smell of that dead animal watching it on the screen like I would have if it were a movie and we could go inside of his head and he's trying not to vomit and like all, you know, that's a really powerful moment that's more powerful in a book than it is on the screen.
I couldn't agree more. And I think that is the reason that so many people say when a movie that was based on a best-selling novel comes out, the movie was good, but the book was better. And I think that's why, because there's something about picturing that because the writing has put that picture in your head than being spoon-fed it the way we are with a movie.
It's also why comic books are so easily adapted to the screen, because comic books are a visual medium. They are using the scene, you know, you talk about, you know, the first paragraph needs to set the scene so you can see it. You're literally doing that with a comic book, right? Before you do the text bubble, you're painting a picture and you're showing, literally showing, instead of telling. It's a wonderful combination of visual art and written art. You know, a lot of people think that comics are a low form of art. And I think that really does a disservice. It shows, I think, an ignorance of understanding of how art works, right? It's like, what makes a opera such a high level of art? It combines acting and music and set design and fashion, right? There's all these different ways that you're communicating together. So that's seen as really high art. And yet we have comic books like, oh, that's for nerdy kids down at the bottom. And I'm like, there's a lot that comic books do really well. And there's a reason why they're movies, even when they're only an okay movie. Because not every comic book movie is great, but even the okay ones are still selling $100 million worth of tickets, which is a lot of money. And the good ones are selling $1 billion worth of tickets. You know, it's considered a failure if it only sells $30 million, whereas there's a lot of films that would kill for those kinds of numbers.
Sure.
So what did you have to learn the hard way about writing cinematically?
I think the biggest thing for me was that I didn't know how to get my characters off the stage. I felt like every time I wrote a scene, I had to start like when the person was waking up in the morning and write clear through to where they went to bed at night. And I remember at one point my husband said, he goes, you know, you can just end a scene. That's how they do it in the movies. They just cut, you know, right in the middle, even sometimes in the middle of a line of dialogue. And that was like a revelation to me that I had these tools at my disposal that I could fade out a scene. I could cut a scene. I could jump forward or I could flash back in time the way movies do. And that just changed everything for me as a writer when I realized that.
And that gives you a lot of control over the pacing as well. This is one of the things that have really improved in television. So movies have had high quality going back decades, but television, early television especially, was really pretty terrible. Even in the 90s, it was pretty terrible. And the reason was because they didn't have a good, easy way to edit, and it was very expensive, and so they went really light on the editing. Whereas now with digital editing, they can edit just as well as film could. And I remember realizing this when I tried to watch The X-Files because I like sci-fi. So my sister and I were like, we're going to watch The X-Files together. We've heard all those great things about it. So we watched The X-Files first episode, and the two detectives are going to go investigate some possible alien stuff. And so they want to show these detectives, you know, going to investigate the aliens. So they show them walking out of the building, the FBI building. They show them getting into the car, and they show them driving to the airport. Then they show them getting off the plane. Then they show driving in the woods to get to the place. It was like, there has been a minute worth of like nothing going on, because it's not like they're having some like really interesting conversation, that this was just a set piece for some character development. It was just them driving. It was a lot of it's just B-roll of an airplane. And this is one of the things that how it would be done now is that they would just show the woods for a second or two to establish here's where we are. And then it would show them in the woods, and it would be so much easier and faster. And this is a development that television now does really well. And you don't even notice it. It's like so quick and subconscious. They're like, here's where we are now. They show the outside of the building, and then they quickly, instantly take you to the inside of the building. And so my advice is, don't be like the X-Files from the 90s. Be like something more modern that cuts straight to the story.
Yes. You're not old enough to remember, Thomas, probably, but it used to be when TV shows needed to show time passing, or especially going back in time, they would show this picture of kind of a swirly look, you know, and that was how they showed that, okay, we're going back in time, because the reader was too dumb to figure that out. And that's one thing that gets written on my manuscripts a lot is, Deb, trust your reader to get it. And that is so important. I think that's, you know, the X-Files weren't trusting their readers to figure out that if we jump from here to the woods, your reader is going to know what happens. So same applies to a novel.
That's right. And it's also a way to save money. So a show I did like was Stargate SG-1, which supposedly takes place in Cheyenne Mountain, which is this, you know, nuclear mountain that the U.S. military has hollowed out. And believe it or not, the whole movie is actually filmed in Canada. So they just sent a film crew to film Cheyenne Mountain, and they have all these little shots of like one guard, two guards, a Jeep driving in, and they'll switch out which ones they show to say, hey, we're in the mountain. But you never see any of the actors walk in there, and you never, exactly. They never have to, and they're able to very inexpensively establish.
And you get it.
That's right. They're able to establish that sense of place. Now, what advice would you give to an author who hates hates Hollywood. They hate everything that Hollywood represents, and they feel like they're betraying their core values by borrowing writing techniques from Hollywood.
I'm going to say sorry, but you seriously, you will do so much better. Force yourself to watch some movies and see how it's done. And this is especially important if you want to capture younger readers. Because, you know, when you go back to the classics and you read Dickens and some of those, the descriptions are almost painful. Now, some people love that and they were beautifully written. I'm not going to say that they weren't. But you have to realize that those were written in an era when you couldn't just say Paris and the whole world had a picture of what that looks like. You had to describe for the person in the middle of Dakota Territory, you know, in the 1800s, what Paris looked like. That is why they wrote that way. We have a distinct advantage, you know, living in this century that almost everybody, if you can name any major city, and we have an image in our mind immediately. We don't need to do a lot of description for that. But if you want to capture young readers, you need to write so that they are reading like a movie experience, because that's what they grew up on. That's what they like best. And that is what they relate to. They live in a very technical visual world. And really, even if you're writing historical, that's still how they are going to consume it, is as the visual.
That's so good, because that was part of the appeal of the early books. I think it was Victor Hugo, Hunchback of Notre Dame. One of the chapters is just a bird's eye view of Paris. And all he does is describe different buildings in Paris. And to us today, we're like, oh my gosh, this is so boring, because we're used to seeing photos and videos of Paris. But just like you say, people may have never seen a single photo of Paris in their entire life. And somebody describing it in words was like, wow, this is amazing.
Yeah, I actually like I want to read
this. Right. And this is why knowing your audience is so important, and realizing your audience of people in the 2020s is not the same as somebody's audience in the 1860s. And another example of this done really well is Tom Clancy in his book, I think it was Clear and Present Danger. He takes 30 pages to describe how a nuclear bomb works.
Which is why that's all the further I got in his book, the first right. book of his I tried to read.
There you go. Because you weren't his target audience, right?
Exactly,
so there's a certain kind of person that is
I liked his movies.
Who's like, oh my gosh, you're going to describe the inner workings of a nuclear bomb for 30 pages? Pass, right? But the kind of reader he was writing to, and there was millions of these, were like, thank you. I wanted my whole life to understand how a nuclear bomb works. And this is basically everything that's not classified about how a nuclear bomb works. And they're devouring those pages on how a nuke works. And here's the deal. Only one person gets to do that, right? Like, the next guy can't spend 30 pages describing a nuclear bomb, because that target audience has already learned it from Clancy. And knowing who you're targeting, who you're not targeting, is really important. And it's also, it's not just important for how you write your book, but it's also important for how you get feedback, right? If Tom Clancy had gotten feedback from Deborah Rainey and she's like, I didn't like that nuclear bomb, 30 pages, oh my gosh, nobody wants to read this because you didn't want to read this. And if he'd been like, you're right, I need to cut that, the book would have been worse for the, you know, Vietnam veteran readers that he was primarily targeting.
And you know what? I have made a similar mistake in wanting to impress readers who were not my target audience, wanting to impress the literary novel readers and wanting to impress men, you know, or whoever else I thought I could maybe draw into my little circle. But I need to remember that my little circle likes the family drama, the touch of romance, those kind of things. And for anybody who doesn't, they're not my reader and they're not my concern.
And targeting literary readers is always a trap, because their favorite thing to do with a book is not be impressed by it.
Oh, so true.
That's how they get their psychological identities. People look down their nose at books. And if that's a really kind of vicious audience to try to target. And there's not very many of them, and they don't spend very much money. And so if that's your audience, if it's the other people who went to writing school, don't target them. They're too toxic.
I could agree. Yes.
So we're almost out of time, but where should Christian authors go if they want to learn more about cinematic writing? What helped you along the way?
One of the biggest things, like I said, was going to a website that had just definitions of movie terms and looking at those with not the eyes of a filmmaker, but with the eyes of a writer, and think, okay, if they can do this in a movie, how could I translate this to the book? And I think about, there's a thing called the magic hour, that time, either first thing in the morning, at twilight or at dawn, you know, when the light is just perfect. And I have a husband who's a photographer. And so I've spent many times, you know, we have to hurry and get somewhere before the sun comes up so we can be there all set up to capture those moments. Writers have a wonderful advantage. We can put the magic hour in our novels anytime we want to, but we have to do it with description and with words. So there's a ton of terms, establishing shots and jump cuts and zooms and dissolves. Go read what those movie terms mean and then be creative and think of a way that you can accomplish that exact thing with your writing. That helped me a lot.
Because you wouldn't want to use the word jump cut in your writing.
No, for sure
but
not.
You want
no.
Do that action of a jump cut and realize how filmmakers will use that as a technique of creating tension or drawing out tension. It, you know, it's kind of like there's a set of ingredients. It's almost like learning a new cuisine, right? You've grown up and you've learned nothing but, you know, down home cooking from wherever you're from. And there's this other kind of cuisine called French cuisine. It has some things in common, but other things are different. And sometimes it's got ingredients you've never used before, or other times it just uses ingredients you're familiar with, but use them in a different way. And learning that new cuisine, and in this case, it's filmmaking or screenwriting, will enhance your cooking of your own cuisine. And this is what happened with American food. When we started getting contact with other cuisines from around the world, we're like, that's a nice spice. I think I'll steal it, right? Like garlic used to be this, you know, pejorative, right? In the movie, It's a Wonderful Life, you know, Potter's like, garlic eaters, right? It's like only, you know, dirty Italians eat garlic. And, you know, since then we're like, you know what? Garlic's actually pretty useful. We can use it in lots of things beyond just Italian food. And you can do the same with your writing if you're reading books on screenwriting. There's a whole, you know, section in Amazon of books on screenwriting. I think the one most screenwriters start with is Save the Cat. It's perhaps the most controversial. People either love it or hate it. I don't know where you are on the Save the Cat. Are you pro or con Save the Cat?
I must be somewhere in the middle because I think I read half of it and decided, okay, I get the point. So. But that's a great analogy, the cooking thing. It really is.
Yeah. So I encourage you to read Save the Cat and you can decide whether you like it or not. And then you can read the second most popular book on screenwriting and see if you like that one better. But real quick before we go, Deb, do you have any final tips or encouragement?
I would just say, be thoughtful of your reader when you're writing. Don't just think about what you want to say, because then it will probably come off preachy and like it's a message rather than a story. Think about your reader. Think about making them as comfortable as they can be while they are reading your book. And by comfortable, I don't mean so comfortable that they close the book and go to bed, but just that they feel like, yes, I'm connecting to everything. I see what I'm supposed to see. I get to know these characters as if they're my own friends, that type of thing. I think when we are mindful of our reader in that way, that our stories then come alive for those readers, and that's how you get fans.
The secret was given to us by Jesus, right? If you want to be a leader, if you want to be first, you must be a servant. So you have to think about serving your reader, just like what you're saying. And a lot of authors want to be on top. They want to be the master. They want to be the one on the throne. And they don't realize that the actual path to success is following Christ and serving the reader and giving the reader what they want and blessing the reader rather than trying to bless yourself.
Preach it, brother.
We get a little bit of preachy on this podcast from time to time. If you want to find out more about Deborah Rainey, I'll have a link to her website, deborahrainey.com. You can also follow her on Twitter. The sponsor this week is the Christian Writers Institute, and the course of the week is Beyond Mediocrity by Cece Murphy. Using Jesus as an example, which I recommend, author Cece Murphy encourages the writer who is a Christian to honor God by reaching beyond mediocrity in their writing. writing. By working hard, studying the craft, and persevering, Murphy exhorts those writing for the Christian marketplace to produce their best possible work. And you can find this at the Christian Writers Institute. You can save 10% at checkout with the coupon code podcast, or click the link in the show notes. I think this course is like $6 or $7, so it's not very expensive with or without the coupon code. Deborah Rainey, thank you so much for joining us today on the Christian Publishing Show.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Love the conversation.
Thank you for listening to the Christian Publishing Show. For more information and to get episodes delivered to your phone automatically, visit ChristianPublishingShow.com.